Welcome to the Reason Roundtable. We're the editors of the political magazine that's allergic to politics. Gather each Monday to inoculate the news. That's right. I'm Matt Welsh, joined by Peter Suderman, Nick Gillespie. Thank you. And Catherine Mangue Ward. Hi, gang.
Howdy.
Happy Monday.
That intro gave me COVID, Matt Welsh.
We're going to, in a moment, try to remember one of the most forgettable major presidential speeches that took place last week. But first, on October 2nd, 2018, Washington Post journalist Jamal Khashoggi entered the Saudi consulate in Istanbul, Turkey. He was never seen alive again. At a time when America is busy looking inward, there's one movie reminding us that there are unbelievable events unfolding across the globe. The new documentary, The Dissident, fearlessly examines the details and intrigues surrounding the brazen murder that shocked the world. The Dissident not only unearths new proof, it ultimately exposes Khashoggi's real killers. As Rand Paul says, the evidence is overwhelming that the Crown Prince was involved. Senator Lindsey Graham adds, there's not a smoking gun, there's a smoking saw. The Associated Press calls The Dissident a real-life thriller playing out at the highest levels of power and wealth. Are you ready for the truth? From the Academy Award-winning director of Icarus comes The Dissident, now playing at home on demand. Visit thedissident.com for more viewing information. Watch it today. You'll be glad you did. Okay, so a funny thing happened over the last 8 days. First, they held an Academy Awards, and nobody except perhaps Peter Suderman watched. Viewership was down 58%. Then Joe Biden gave his non-State of the Union, State of the Union address last Wednesday, and viewership was way down for that, too, around 38% from Donald Trump's levels in 2020. We're going to examine some of the specifics of Biden's speech since presidential rhetoric, particularly during moments of crisis, can have significant implications for policy and politics. But first, Catherine, let's muse for a moment on the audience exit here. Since you are a non-voter who loves non-politics, does it make your heart warm to see such a big opt-out, and or does it worry you that that's happening as we're seeing the expansion of the federal government to sort of LBJ, FDR levels? Could it be a bad thing when people tune out Leviathan?
Yeah, it could be a bad thing when you say it like that. Doesn't sound great. I think not watching a blowhardy ceremonial speech by whoever happens to be president is probably a perfectly good and healthy choice on the part of the American people. On the other hand, the fact that we have no tools at all at this point really left to us to check the bi-monthly $2 trillion spending bills that we have been doing and that are certainly not unique to Joe Biden.
Is it bi-monthly or is it fortnightly? I think it's important to make that
well,
clear.
I meant to say every 2 months. This is actually why the word bi-monthly is bad. So
it's
I take
semi-
it back. Quarterly. We'll call it a quarterly. You know, I think we can stretch it out a little. Our quarterly $2 trillion, we should be keeping tabs on that. If there was any mechanism whereby watching quasi-State of the Union addresses helped check that, I would clockwork orange everybody, prop their eyeballs right open, sit them down. But that's not how it works, unfortunately.
Nick, you are objectively pro-atomization, always have been. Is there any downside to the conclusion?
I think atoms are the best molecule, Matt. They're pre-molecule.
Did you just say, are there any downside to atoms?
Are there any downside to atoms, man? You've been taking the drugs. No, is there the implosion of the mass audience, Nick? Will you at long last admit that that's the real problem?
Yeah, it is, really. You know, ever since Walter Cronkite stopped acting as Zardoz and giving us the news on a nightly basis, we, you know, obviously things are, it's just been downhill. All we have left are saffron-colored bikinis.
Do you think he wore the thigh-high Zardoz boots? No, it's not. Like, we've focused way too much on the mankini and
on
not nearly enough on Sean Connery's thigh-high boots.
That's because the boots don't need any more analysis. They're objectively great. They are appropriate for every occasion.
His suspenders and, the fake ponytail is also pretty great, too.
Yes. The male pattern balding ponytail. But no, seriously, there's a part of the critique right now in sort of political discourse. There's the fear of the big tech on one hand, but then there's also like, hey, we don't even have any common truths anymore.
Yeah, that's really not true. But, you know, it's obviously it's a good thing that media has, you know, now is as varied as all other aspects of our lives so that we can actually seek out more things that we find interesting. We can produce and consume everything on our own. And the idea that that somehow is the reason for a massive swollen state, I think these things are, you know, they're unconnected to one another. I do think that the, you know, the bigger problem here, and it is a decades-long trend, which is towards bigger and bigger government. And I think that has to do with a hollowing out for, you know, partly a hollowing out of trust and confidence in major institutions, particularly the government. And that's not because we now have 57 channels with nothing on, as the bard Bruce Springsteen put it about 1,000 years ago, but it's because people are more and more inclined to ask for some kind of big power to make everything right in their world, or same thing, extremists in the parties have been able to commandeer a process by which they get concentrated benefits at dispersed costs to taxpayers.
Speaking of the concentrated benefits, Peter, let's start talking about now the contents of the speech and the significance thereof. What did you pull out of the non-SODU-SODU?
So what stuck out to me were a couple of related things. First, the crisis framing. So you mentioned, you know, this is a speech being given in a crisis. And the very first words in Biden's speech were, "Tonight, I come to talk about crisis." That's his lead, right? It's the very first and most important thing that he wants people to hear. And so it becomes kind of the framing for everything that follows, and also the justification. Except that what followed was not, in many ways, a speech about how to respond to crisis, which by definition is a temporary emergency requiring unusual measures that are designed to end. Instead, Biden's speech proposed a long list of permanent changes, in most cases, expansions of federal power and spending, and in some cases, expansions of programs that had already gone into effect thanks to the first round of nearly $2 trillion in new spending, the recovery bill, programs that were initially pitched as temporary programs, as responses that we only need for a year or two. And so that includes that initial bill had $34 billion in additional spending for Obamacare over 2 years. And now Biden wants another $200 billion or so to make it permanent. The initial recovery plan had $100 billion to expand the child tax credit, turning it basically into a monthly parent, what some folks have likened to a UBI for parents, which is effectively, and Biden basically wants to extend it to 2025, but that's pretty much a call to make it permanent. If we extend it now to 2025, it's going to get reauthorized again, and maybe it's always a 3 or 4 year program, but it's a call to make it permanent effectively. And so all of this got smuggled in via the crisis framing, right? The idea that we are in a crisis justified a lot of must-do things that aren't crisis response in any real sense. And it's even more maddening, I think, because to the extent we are in a crisis, that crisis is subsiding. Los Angeles just had a zero COVID death day. DC has been hovering around a 7-day average of 0 or 1 deaths per day on a 7-day rolling basis. Cases are falling across the country. Hiring is picking up. The economy is getting back in gear. The crisis was real. And to some extent, it's still with us, but it's ebbing. And Biden is just using it here for an excuse for massive, massive power grabs and massive expansions of government spending.
Catherine, what's a takeaway that you had from the speech?
I grudgingly watched it, despite my previous claim that it won't help at all for anyone to watch it. And I was struck, as I often am in these speeches, two things. One, there was like one very specific, very urgent message that he could have used this national platform to give. And it was like, hey, everybody get vaccinated. And he did that. But then he went on and kind of muted it with like all the normal laundry list garbage. And I did have this moment actually this morning as I was rereading the speech of like, what if he had just done a get vaccinated PSA? Like, I'm seeing headlines this morning that are like, we're not going to reach herd immunity. Like, if we're really in a crisis, if this really is a special, weird, once in a lifetime situation, why was this a normal State of the Union? So I did have that reaction. But more specifically, I wanted to point to the line, we're in competition with China and other countries to win the 21st century.
Yes.
No, we're not. That's not how this works. That's
Tell
not
it to
how
Sora
any
Amari,
of this
Catherine.
Works. We
wait, wait,
are.
Wait, wait, wait. So you're against winning the future?
Yeah, I hate the winning. I just want to stop winning.
I want to know who judges
You're finally
this.
Sick of
finally
winning.
Finally sick of right, winning. Like, right, so obviously
the, like
we...
what the point scoring system is for determining
who wins the 21st century.
I think it's the same body that determines world's greatest dad, mom, and teacher.
Yeah, everybody gets a mug.
I think it's like one of those Olympic things where you dive off the platform and then like the three guys hold up, or sometimes it's ladies, whatever, but like the judges hold up like a 9.7 and a 9.0 right
yeah.
at the end, you tabulate how many points
that's how it's going to work.
All
yeah.
the countries have.
No, any of that, but like any of that, what you guys just described would actually make more sense than what Joe Biden probably means here, which is something like our trade deficits with China maybe are a thing that he's factoring in here, or if like a major scientific breakthrough happened in China instead of here that like benefited all of humanity, like God forbid. No, it's all wrong. Like we should be thinking of ourselves as at the nation level as being not in competition with anyone. Now, individuals should be in competition with each other. Businesses should be in competition with each other. Nations thinking themselves as being in competition with each other ends badly, and it is the wrong mental framework. But it's a totally standard State of the Union line. So there it is, a normal State of the Union thing to say, which is like poisonous and off topic.
If we get Pete Buttigieg's dream of, you know, 75% of Americans are taking the train all the time and you can hear the rumble of the rails.
To their national service jobs, which may or may not be mandatory.
Right.
Thank
well,
you.
And two
While
sentences.
While wearing Amtrak branded yeah. masks that you're going to be required to
By
wear
law.
On Amtrak.
Aboard.
Two sentences keys. Later, in fact, we did have Biden valorizing the Transcontinental Railroad, and then, by the way, moving on to say...
Well, you know, that was a very important moment in his youth when he saw the Continental Railroad get connected in Promontory Point, Utah.
John
the Golden Spike. He remembers the Golden Spike. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Nick, so. What was a policy takeaway that curdled your milk?
Well, by the way, no adult should be drinking milk. No adult humans.
Almond milk, even?
No, that's not milk, Matt Welch. That's a metaphorical
Oh, what are you, the milk lobby now, Nick? Come on, man.
No, I'm the anti-milk. I'm the anti-milk
wait,
lobby.
What
there
about
should only be milk alternatives.
Milk punch, which is delicious you make it right.
Yeah. Hey, you know what? Save that for your Substack, Peter.
Wow.
Okay.
This is a
Ooh. Reason podcast.
Spicy.
It's not cocktail hour.
I'm pro milk on all platforms as long as there's booze involved.
Well, that goes a long way to solving the milk problem, right? And making it more drinkable. I love milk. I just want to say that to all of my milk friends and people. And I realize I made a terrible mistake.
Yeah.
And I didn't mean what I said plainly. I don't know what happened.
Do we think we could keep saying that word enough times that it loses all meaning?
Milk?
No. Somebody
taught
me.
Although I am going to name my memoir, the first volume of my memoir, Milk.
So
Matt,
tell us.
I think the important thing about the State of the Union stuff.
Nothing. I was just going to say, after last couple podcasts ago, when we talked about how the word jobs had lost its meaning, if you said it enough times, somebody actually replied in a tweet to note that this phenomenon is called satiation, or like verbal satiation or something, where milk, we've become satiated.
Milk jobs.
Go.
We have milked milk to death. Jobs are everywhere. I think the large frames that Catherine and Peter were talking about are really important, because what ultimately is happening under a Biden presidency, and again, I think this is a decades-long culmination of a movement towards an acceptance or a push to have the government be involved in every aspect of virtually every aspect of our lives. And he has done that. And, you know, to talk about things that, you know, we're in a crisis, we're in a panic, we need jobs, we need to win at the national level and at the international level. When you start to drill down on Joe Biden's specific programs, and in this sense, this was, you know, a great State of the Union address, because it was a Clintonian laundry list of how much money and how many places he was going to spend And one of the things that caught my mind was the bazillion dollars for community colleges, because finally America was delivering on what the founders promised everybody was free community college, as if, and this goes to, things like the declining rates of COVID, as well as, the idea that the vaccines were already, things were happening before Biden even got into office. At community college, he's promising free community college. 20 states already have free community college. So it's like, well, that's pretty good. He's really getting ahead of the curve there. But it's also the idea where he is just promising more and more things. Community college, and of course, Dr. Jill is a community college stalwart. That's where she taught as a doctor, Professor Jill, at a community college in Northern Virginia. But this exemplifies a lot of problems. One is just let's give billions of dollars for something that is already taking place. These are programs that have terrible track records. In fact, when you look at how many people graduate, how many people complete community college courses and degrees and succeed because of that, every newspaper story will lead with an anecdote of somebody, typically a non-traditional college student, who takes a couple of courses at community college and then becomes some kind of success. But in fact, if you treat community colleges like private nonprofit colleges, they have kind of completion rates that would trigger federal investigations if they were Trump University or the University of Phoenix and things like that. And instead of saying, and I'm not sure how I feel about this, but instead of saying something like, education really is important, like ongoing learning, constantly upgrading your skills, being able to shift from one industry that disappears because of the beauty of creative destruction and global trade and innovation and things like that, we're going to make it easier for people to be able to get training or education when they need it. This is saying we're going to fund a bunch of schools, a bunch of buildings that already do a mediocre job, and we're just going to give them more money, and then you can show up there and you can get free stuff. It's exactly the same kind of democratic model of, increasing K-12 schooling. Whatever you do, don't give it to the fucking parents or the kids who actually have to suffer through these, minimum security prison complex programs. Give it to the people who already exist and things like that. And on top of—
But I mean, that's so endemic of the Biden approach
that,
so far.
No, it is. That's what I'm
saying. I think
we're going
to see for a couple of years here, which is his solution to absolutely every perceived problem, some of which are real, some of which are not, in American life is just to throw more money at
give
it.
Money, but it's not throwing money.
Absolute lack of budgetary constraints in a way that I don't think I've ever seen before, at least not in my lifetime, from an American president.
Well, two things on that. One is, yes, it's throw more money, but it's throw more money at specific interest groups that benefit from the money, not the supposed beneficiary. So he's not saying, okay, preschool, we're going to give parents more money to go to, send their kids to preschool. We're going to give more money for parents to send their kids through K-12 or students to go to community college or to a four-year college where they're much more likely to actually graduate than from a community college. We're going to give it to the power structures that exist so that they shut up and they vote for me in the future.
No, that's exactly right. If you look at the infrastructure plan, the actual worst thing in the infrastructure plan, I just want to add this in, is there is $400 billion for long-term care. And this would go through the Medicaid program. And the long-term, and it's $400 billion, not because there is any reason to spend exactly $400 billion. There's not even like a long-time proposal out there that some Democratic wonk has been like, we need $400 billion to do this, to make program reforms. It's just $400 billion because it's a really big number. And they don't
but
even
it's not
really
too
know
big
what they'd spend it on.
Because $450 billion, that would be reckless, right?
Sure,
and
right?
That gets to your—
They don't even really know what they would spend it on, except that that money would go disproportionately to SEIU employees. And because they're union employees, Biden's like, let's give them more money to do the thing they're already doing that isn't working.
The other aspect of this is the lack of interest in budgetary, seriousness, so that even his various things, like, because he's saying we're gonna give a lot more people more money, we're also gonna soak the rich in a way that doesn't even come close to paying for what he's talking about. But it has the right cadence of like, okay, well, that's good. He's gonna soak the rich and give me more money. What's
the
not to
one
like?
Line
even
that
if
stuck
I'm rich.
In my craw and is immediately being quoted in things like the New York Times, remarkably crappy, and that has to be something special to get an extra adjective there, remarkably crappy editorial over the weekend calling for national service. They use this quote from the address in service of that, which is, "It's time we remembered that we, the people, are the government, you and I," said President Biden.
That is so deep. That, by the way, that New York Times article pushing for national service. And again, they wouldn't come flat out and say, is this mandatory or not? But they quote William James, to go back to this idea that we're in a crisis or we have to win stuff. William James, you know, who obviously is a wonderful expert on national service, right? But is that you can't have a pleasure economy, or rather a peace economy cannot simply be a pleasure seeking economy. And it's like, why not? Actually, that is like, do you need a war economy versus a peace economy? But like a peace economy is people going about their business in a voluntary way, enjoying themselves, creating the worlds that they want to live in, and inviting people to join them. That's like, yeah, you don't need national service in a peace economy. And for God's sake, wouldn't it be nice to have a peace economy 25,000 years into the Afghanistan
both
war?
Totally great. Not a problem with those. Another line from that editorial, by the way, was, this is great. "To libertarians, talk of government mandated service smacks of more government imposition on individual liberties."
Yep.
Yeah.
Correct.
You know, somebody, I tweeted about that, and somebody in my feed had a great line where they said, like, you know, why don't people pushing national service ever say, let's enlist old people?
Yeah.
You know, like, why is it always like, I'm going to take, you know, other kids, other parents' kids who aren't as well off or aren't as politically connected to me, and I'm going to make them shovel shit in, you know, the in Minnesota coal mines or something like that. Why don't we take old people, the stars of Nomadland, and make them shovel shit, you know, because they got nothing else to do anyway.
Yeah, and make it make it age dependent, like a Logan's Run situation, like, oh, sorry, you're 50. Were you in mid-career? Did you have plans? Did you make them? Sorry, you're 50 now. You got to go.
Yeah.
You got to go.
You have to go spend a year doing whatever make work
doing some,
Pete Buttigieg can think
training.
Of.
Pete Buttigieg has a lot of holes to dig and a lot of holes to fill.
Speaking of holes to fill, the Biden administration. No, not really. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, otherwise known as the CDC, last week came out with an also already forgotten, long, color-coded, incredibly confusing thing called Choosing Safer Activities, having to do with what vaccinated Americans can and cannot do and how much masks they should be wearing, and so on. In the wake of all of that, the president and various CDC officials and other senior administration types gave a series of interviews and totally contradictory and confusing messages about this, with Biden saying that covering your face, this was in a NBC News interview, covering your face was a, quote, patriotic responsibility, even if you're vaccinated and you're...
It was exciting to see that unprotected anal sex is now considered safer than in-person kindergarten instruction.
Catherine,
how times change.
I don't know how we can get Christopher Nolan to subtract the last 30 seconds from the future, but can you at least start us off with...
Just furiously like, spinning tops over here trying to...
Why? They're color coding. Has there been a single color code from the federal government that ended well? Like even one?
No. No. I mean, I'm old enough to remember the post 9/11 color codes, but the thing that's particularly remarkable about that graphic is that I looked at it for like a really long time. And I think it's just like a statement of fact to say, like, I'm pretty smart. I'm a pretty smart gal. And I do words paired with pictures for a living. Like, that's what I do. And I still was like, there are many activities that I do on like a normal daily basis that this chart does not give me information about what I'm supposed to do. Like, that was the worst part about it for me. It was just like, the chart was so elaborate, yet did not contain answers to the questions what should I do in my normal life if I wanted to be fully CDC compliant? But the thing that I actually was dying over this week on the internet was a meme that existed, for me at least, on every single platform, which was people saying, I want to follow the CDC guidance and unmask while I'm outdoors, but I don't want people to think I'm a Republican. What to do? And that is just, that is exactly what is wrong with America right now. That thing right there.
You just don't wear a mask, but you do one of those, wear one of those, like, in our house we believe shirts.
Great deal. I will personally print up 300 million of those shirts if that's what people need to take off their masks. But yes, that the idea that wearing or not wearing a mask was the science up until it came down to brass tacks. And then it was like, oh, no, this was always signaling about my tribal affiliation. And now I don't know what to do. Insane.
Peter, talked about it before. But CDC very clearly in its internal perusings about, you know, the next terrible thing that happens and how we should react to it back in 2006 said, above all, you really have to have clear information and just be honest about what you know and what you don't know, because you don't want to lose trust with the public. At this point, it's a cliche about how that just hasn't really played out in this pandemic in a sometimes disastrous way. Is there like an incentive structure at the root of all of this? Is there some kind of public choice explanation? Why, how could they continue to get messaging so horrible? And if those of you out there who haven't been reading Zeynep Tufekci from The Atlantic, and I'm sorry for mispronouncing her Turkish name, she's been great about this throughout the pandemic, talking about just the botching of the messaging about the known science. But is there some kind of like structural explanation for how badly they continue to this day to do it in such a way that probably at this point is contributing to vaccine hesitancy, among other things?
So if you have the saying is that if you have a hammer, everything looks like a nail. So, you know, if you're Thor, everything is a nail to you, right? If you are a public health expert, everything looks like an infectious disease that needs to, that where the, like what you need to do is stop people from doing the things they want to do. And it's really sort of, it's built into the public health community mindset that the tool they have to do the one thing that they want to do, which is prevent the spread of disease, is to restrict people's liberties. That's the only tool they have. And you can see that in, you know, going back to Michael Bloomberg's New York with the, you know, the smoking bans and the restrictions on like soda sizes and every stupid little thing.
Trans fats.
Right. And so the public health worldview is people are doing things that might cause them to be sick in some way, right? That might cause there to be additional disease in the world. And therefore, what we need to do is to stop them through government interventions. That is it, right? And so they don't think about doing anything else. There's never any real balancing test. Yes, they'll sort of make noises about like, oh, well, we do want to, you know, we do care about the economy too, but they don't in any way. They're public health people. They're not economists. And so I actually think, you know, there was a, I've been thinking about this and the relationship in some ways between public health and economics recently. They're often kind of portrayed as opposed to each other. But in many ways, they sort of play, they have come to play somewhat similar roles in policymaking. There was an Ezra Klein column in the New York Times just a few weeks ago that said, yes, I'm sorry. Yes, that is an appropriate sigh. We need more of those. But he reported out and others confirmed that within the Biden administration is simply downplaying the role of economists in policymaking. They view the role of economists as to describe the situation with the economy, and maybe to lay out some proposals, but not to be sort of the definitive people making policymaking decisions. But the Democratic sort of coalition has at the same time been rallying around the public health community and letting the public health community do the thing that they're saying economists shouldn't do. And so this isn't, I'm not, to be clear, making an argument that economists shouldn't be making policy recommendations. What I'm saying is, what Democrats have done is take a group of people whose actual value is to describe the course and characteristics of diseases And in fact, the epidemiologists who predicted that hundreds of thousands of people could die, who said this was going to be the course of the disease back in February, March, April, they've been in many ways directionally correct, or, you know, sort of more right about describing sort of what the vaccine, what the virus's characteristics were. And where they have been absolutely terrible is on policymaking and on recommendations for how individuals should make decisions about themselves. And that's how we get charts like these, which I just, I have to say, when I looked at this, the first thing I thought of was Magic the Gathering. I don't know if you guys have ever played Magic the Gathering, but it's a somewhat complicated card game, sort of not quite a role-playing game. It's a little bit like super nerdy Pokemon in some ways for those folks who have kids who have played Pokemon here. But when you get somewhat deep into the game of Magic the Gathering, you have a huge number of quite complex rules that come into play around what's called stacking order. And so you've got all these cards on the table, and there are all these different effects, and you have to play them in a certain, like in a certain order, and the stacking order gets really complicated, and you have to, and so there are all these rules about what special effects trigger depending on which types of cards are in play, and there's a huge amount of lawyering and special case exemptions that basically amount to like magic case law that you end up having to know. I definitely don't recommend this game for normal people who enjoy doing things that are actually fun. But the CDC chart reminds me of that.
Yeah, you're doing a good job of selling
it. Even color-coded, right? Like you play with your yellow. Is this a yellow activity or a green activity, right? Oh, I'm doing it. I'm doing a yellow activity now. That means I have to wear my mask half on my face but stuck under my chin to like show off my scraggly beard. I mean, every single environment and circumstance has some very slightly different rule to remember and like deep magic lawyering. It's just not going to be practical for most people. It's not in any way practical, just completely independent of whether it's accurate.
I'll point out also that the Magic the Gathering is widely believed to be a pipeline into Satanism, which I think also applies to the CDC reopening chart.
I will say, my hard line of a nerd thing I will not do, which is, to be clear, always creeping downward, used to be north of Dungeons and Dragons and now sits solidly right above Magic the Gathering.
So you know, just, though, you can go to community college for free get a 2-year associate's degree in Magic the Gathering.
I just got a 2-year associate's degree in Magic the Gathering. That's how long that explanation took.
Well, you know, for me, the message, and I believe it was Jesse Walker, our colleague at Reason, who put up this fantastic image from the Baltimore City Health Department, where it's a stock photo of a woman who looks like, I'm assuming the original thing was something where her boyfriend or significant other is blurred out in the background. It's kind of bitching at her, and she's scowling. I assume this is taken from an old STD campaign. But he's saying, mimosas with the girls? You still aren't vaxxed, Deborah. And it's like a Roy Lichtenstein.
A single tear runs down her face.
Cartoon where it's like, you know, I don't care. I would rather, you know, I'd rather drown than call Brad for help. I mean, this is so fundamentally stupid and pathetic. But it's also, and this goes for what everybody else was talking about, this is the nightmare that Thomas Sowers and Michel Foucault talked about, of where public health becomes everything. It's in all the messaging. It's in all the billboards. It's in every activity. It's in all of the regulations that cover every goddamn moment of everyday life. And the only thing that matters, I mean, it's like a warped version of 1984, where you know, the only thing that matters, like, are you vaccinated so that we can win the future against China or Eurasia or whoever the hell, you know, we're at war with for the current moment or whatever. And it's something that really needs to be called out, made totally explicit, and then mocked and ridiculed and dismantled. And I worry that the kind of medicalization of everyday life in the name of public health and in the name of national economic greatness and all of this kind of stuff, it's everywhere. And this is, I think, where the you know, the cultural war against the idea that your life, your body, your will, your desire, your hopes don't belong to you. They are only, you know, they are subjugated to whatever Joe Biden's, you know, heartburn, whatever insight and whatever vision that's giving him in a particular
moment. I would just add that the CDC and the public health world have been doing this for decades, going back to stuff like the food pyramid, which was totally wrong. And for the most part, Americans have been pretty good about ignoring them. Not perfectly, but pretty good about ignoring them. And we should go back to ignoring them immediately.
But it's hard, and I agree, but this is where COVID and, you know, the Italian philosopher Giorgio Agamben, who talks a lot about special periods, COVID provided a pretext where you could take a lot of this stupidity and really kind of operationalize it so that you have governments at every level deciding what's an essential business, what's a non-essential business, and it takes on the force of law.
Got to say, Nick, I missed hearing sirens in your feed. It makes me feel...
It's a sign that things are alive.
That's right.
In Lower Manhattan.
New York's coming back. We're going to talk more about vaccine hesitancy, including libertarian vaccine hesitancy, in a moment. But first, is your mental and emotional state of being weighing you down and preventing you from experiencing happiness or achieving your goals? Let's get you to start living a happier life beginning today. Visit betterhelp.com/roundtable and get instant confidential access to a network of licensed mental health professionals in all 50 states. Betterhelp.com, that's H-E-L-P, like what Joe Biden sometimes needs to find his mask, has helped more than 1 million people take charge of their own mental health. Listeners to the Reason Roundtable can get a special deal, 10% off your first month. BetterHelp.com is more affordable than traditional online counseling services. Financial aid is also available. Soon, hopefully, that depression, stress, anxiety, insomnia, and whatever will be in the rearview mirror. Go to the website, BetterHelp.com/roundtable. Describe your issues and desires, and you'll be set up with someone to talk to within 24 hours. Do it today. You'll be glad you did. All right. Our listener email of the week extends the conversation we were just having about COVID. Reminder, please email all your queries to roundtable@reason.com and try to be briefish so that we can read it in full or partly in full. Today comes from Tom. A little longer than usual, but there's some information here that's good. He asks, for decades, I've been a sometimes small, sometimes large L libertarian, comfortable in the knowledge that our positions are the rational, well-thought-out ones. The current anti-vax sentiment within a significant portion of the libertarian world has me questioning everything, though. I'm not talking vaccine passports, which I oppose, but the bizarrely aggressive knee-jerk anti-vax sentiment that seems to be making its way into mainstream libertarianism. Weren't we the folks who, a mere couple of years ago, were saying get the FDA out of the way so Big Pharma can cure things? That literally happened, and now a significant number of libertarians are kvetching about how quickly the vaccines were developed. I work as an attorney for Big Pharma, and the information about why the process was so fast is not difficult to find. After the test kit debacle, the FDA really did get out of the way as much as they ever have. Additionally, half of the work was done already. Other recent scares, such as SARS, were viruses that were similar enough to COVID-19 that we were able to piggyback on a lot of work that was already done. So here's my question to the panel. How can I have faith in the rationality, dare I say the reason, of libertarianism when there is a significant portion of the movement that is so breathtakingly wrong on vaccines? I'm not happy about this, but it makes me question everything else about libertarianism if we're so willing to dispense with reason this easily. Catherine, help out Tom.
Your politics are not an indicator of whether you are a good person, whether you are a smart person, or whether you are a rational person. And I think that that can be hard for people who hold minority political views or people whose identity is tightly bound up in their politics to accept. Every political movement contains people who are bad people. Every political movement contains people who are irrational people. Every political movement contains people who are dumb. And while I'm not saying that people who refuse vaccines are bad, irrational, and dumb, I think that it would be a mistake to look to someone's politics to predict anything other than their politics and anything other than how they will vote or how they would choose to side on a given political issue. I would love for every libertarian to be a model of kindness and rationality and, you know, good pro-social behavior, but that is not the case, and it never will be. That is not a referendum on libertarianism, and it shouldn't be taken that way. There's a real risk in that. If you say only people who agree with me about everything and conform to all of my views, you know, belong in my political tribe. Your tribe will be too small to do anything. It's going to be ad hoc coalitions. And that, unfortunately, that's always going to just mean there are people that you disagree with. Your analysis, Tom, seems extremely sound of why the vaccine was fast, about why people should not regard vaccines with suspicion, even as they perhaps should regard vaccine passports with some suspicion. But not every libertarian is going to feel that way. It's not a referendum on libertarianism.
Peter, can you respond without using Magic the Gathering?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's actually going to be pretty hard for me to not. I'm gonna pull from a lot of mana here that I've got on the table. No, I think, you know, there's sort of two things.
We don't even know what that reference is.
There's a couple of things going on here. One is that some of these folks are just doing it to get attention. They're doing it to be edgy, especially if they're sort of performatively resisting vaccination in online forums. But it's also true that there are many people who are hesitant, who just aren't quite sure about this whole fastest vaccine in history using a brand new technology thing. And they are, in my view, mistaken. I think people should get vaccinated. I think it is better for you, and I think it is better for the people around you. But there are folks who have concerns that they feel are important and valid, and they're not doing it just to be jerks and just to get attention. They have different information ecosystems than those of us on this podcast, or than people who are lawyers for Big Pharma. They may not know how to look up regulatory compliance documents or how to parse, you know, phase three trial results. That information is out there, but it's not always super accessible to a lot of people. And so what I would say here is, to some extent, you know, I would recommend doing something that I have not always modeled well myself, which is to be empathetic and patient, rather than to dismiss people and their legitimate, even illegitimate, even unfounded but sincerely held concerns. And to some extent, it is up to us to make the argument that getting vaccinated is good, that it's good for them and for their families and for the rest of us. We have to make the case, and we have to do it with grace and without high-handedness.
Nick, I would just, before you say anything, mention that the two people who I have met who are the most kind of conspiratorial, like, oh, dude, you don't even think about getting vaccine, both worked for vaccine developing companies. Just maybe having inside information can be a bad thing, too. What say you to Tom, Nick?
Well, I want to get vaccinated because I think it's going to bring me closer to Bill Gates. I think I'm one step closer to running Microsoft. In 2015, and this goes to some stuff that both Catherine and Peter were talking about, in 2015, Pew conducted a survey and found about 12% of liberals and 10% of conservatives believe that childhood vaccines were unsafe. So you have a kind of, you know, and because it's Pew, they didn't ask libertarians. But there's a strong, I think there's a strong reason to believe that vaccine skepticism is kind of, it's across the political spectrum in roughly equal percentages. To speak to Peter's point about empathy, for people who are not libertarian edgelord douchebags, which I think is most, you know, the people that we're probably talking about here, the fact that they are concerned about a vaccine is worth treating empathetically. And it's also, you know, it's part of a piece in a world where all of our authorities, you know, whether we're talking about religious, political, commercial, tastemaking in the arts and things like that, have been revealed to be self-interested, awful, dissembling, you know, at best, and just right, you know, downright evil and misleading at worst. And so, you know, there's something to talk about there. Within the libertarian movement, though, I think there is an edgelord contingent which is flexing, you know, now, and that they are more interested in kind of pushing to the edges of things in order to be, you know, edgy and outspoken and, you know, trying to pull off of the idea that most people are against vaccine passports for various reasons. Most people are against mandatory vaccines in most cases, and we don't need them, you know, but then they want to go a step further. And part of what they're doing there, besides kind of showing themselves to be, you know, just kind of outlandish for media attention, they also do get in the way of looking at the ways in which a freer market in medical innovation and technological breakthroughs gave rise in a rapid fashion, not just to an effective vaccine for COVID, but a whole new platform, the messenger RNA platform. This is the subject of Ron Bailey's recent cover story in Reason, where we now have a platform in which all sorts of bad problems can be inoculated against very quickly and rapidly. And it would have been even quicker. The various pharmaceutical companies, they had already come up with the basic vaccine within a couple of days of the genome of COVID-19 being released. Most of what got in the way were useless efficacy and safety requirements that were put on the FDA that in this case did not necessarily improve safety. They just delayed kind of implementation and testing. So, you know, the creation and implementation of COVID-19 vaccines, that's a total success story for markets. Libertarians should be happy to own that, and we should be talking about that rather than, you know, coming up with weirder and weirder conspiracy theories about how, you know, the Fed is behind, pushing COVID vaccines.
I would just add it's a normal human as well as libertarian impulse to say, hey, I want to be in charge of what I put in my body. We, as someone who curated and wrote the intro to a Reason cover story or forum 5-6 years ago about whether vaccines should be mandatory. Yes, there is a contingent among large L, small L libertarians alike, for whom that is one of the core issues, like absolutely not. And they point out, and I think that it's definitely worth exploring, that it's pretty easy for a public health-minded regime to just keep adding new vaccines, and it makes people uncomfortable. It's the state mandating what your kid has to inject before going to public school. Definitely worth exploration and skepticism. So I think a lot of it comes from that. It's worth taking seriously. And it's also worth, I think, overarching, if you're thinking about this role in libertarianism, to heed what Catherine said, which is basically you can't let your ideas about libertarianism be influenced by the bad behavior of libertarians, or what you perceive as the bad behavior of libertarians. Just that's, you know, you're already walking out the door with that one.
Yeah. I mean, and this was also a thing that they came up several years back, and that actually gave me more pause than this variant of it, which was, you know, the discussion about the libertarian to alt-right pipeline. Another moment where a lot of people who had been describing themselves as libertarians turned out to not share my values, to say the least. And, you know, again, I think there's two ways to respond. And one is to say, oh, no, maybe libertarianism is not all it's cracked up to be. But my values didn't change. And the fact that these idiots borrowed that word isn't a cause for my values to change. And so I think, you know, likewise, vaccine skeptics have a lot more going for them than the alt-right in many ways. As Matt just described, you know, there are a bunch of legitimate sort of threats of state interference by state power. But I think people are going to call themselves what they're going to call themselves. I mean, this is also, if you imagine, like, the American left, right? There's, you know, Joe Biden and I don't know, I was trying to think of, like, the worst human and Chapo Trap House both use some of the same words to describe themselves, but they shouldn't relinquish those words just because the other guy's in the pool.
Let's go to our end of podcast survey of what we've been consuming in the cultural sphere. Peter, why don't you lead us off?
I watched Without Remorse, the new Tom Clancy adaptation that was initially going to be released theatrically last September and instead got bought by Amazon and released on Amazon Prime Video. It stars Michael B. Jordan as a longtime hero of Tom Clancy novels. Jack Kelly, or Jack Clark, sort of has two different names depending on what time a part of the timeline he's in, and it's terrible. It's just incredibly awful. Michael B. Jordan is really good. He's super intense. The best moment in the movie is when the movie sort of stops trying to do anything itself and just lets Jordan, who for reasons that don't make any sense and you don't need to worry about at all, has been locked in prison for killing a Russian diplomat just outside of the Reason office. And Jordan's like preparing himself for a fight with the prison guards. And the movie just sort of like stops for a moment and stops trying to do stuff and just lets him deliver energy to the screen as he pumps himself up to fight off like a battalion of these like SWAT dudes. And Jordan is just great in it, right? He just has so much energy, such incredible physicality. He really deserves a great action franchise, and this just isn't it. The one thing that is sort of fun or sort of interestingly terrible about this movie or to libertarians is that, spoilers, at the end you discover that the villain is, again, spoilers, is the guy who you knew was going to be the secret villain all along because he's played by Guy Pearce, who is only there to like flag for you that this is going to be the villain. He's the Secretary of Defense. And he explains that all of the elaborate stuff that happened in the middle of the movie, none of which matters or makes any sense at all, was done in order to start a war with Russia, to revive the American economy, and to bring people together because America is too polarized. And so you have the final villain monologue. He literally says, you know who won World War II? It wasn't the generals or the admirals. It was the economists. And he goes on to like explain the Keynesian theory of the multiplier and argue that a bunch of government spending on like trucks and airplanes was what brought us out of the recession. And it's totally wrong, right? Like that is a popular myth that simply isn't true. And that economists basically think, yeah, that's not really what happened. But it's completely believable that some DC bureaucrat dingbat would think that it was true and then base his crazy master plan on the idea that what we really need is a war that will spark a whole lot of spending and bring people together.
Hey, can you see my house in the movie?
You cannot, but you can see about two blocks from your house and about two blocks from the Reason office where they have, like, there's a building that I have seen many, many times. I think it's on 17th, might be 18th. It's just outside of DuPont Circle. And that is the exterior of it is the set for the Russian diplomat's office or whatever, where Michael B. Jordan tracks him initially. And then later he goes and murders the guy in a flaming car in the drop-off lane out front of Dulles.
All DC movies should be shot exclusively at and in the Russia house is my point.
Real missed opportunity not to have a confrontation.
Also, Peter, your next Substack podcast should be called Spoiling Bad Movies. Nick, what have you been consuming?
I watched Slashening, The Final Beginning, which is a hilarious, super low-budget horror comedy film. It's put out by Troma Entertainment, for people who are into that. And it is a sequel done by Brandon Basham to his, I think it's 2015 or 16 movie, The Slashening. If you like horror comedy, if you are sick of woke people, and if you want to see the movie that Parasite should have been, watch Slashening, The Final Beginning. It is laugh out loud funny. I saw it in a theater in North Hollywood with about 30 other people. It's great to see in a theater, but it's great to watch online. And if you go to Lemley.com, named for the founder, Carl Lemley of Universal Studios back in the day, you can stream it online. This movie was made for, I don't know, you know, like $30,000 or something. It looks great. It is a great homage to any number of horror slasher type movies. And it is, you know, in the spirit of something like Stephen Colbert's Colbert Report or Son of the Beach, the old Howard Stern produced Baywatch parody. It is a perfect representation of the thing it is parodying mercilessly. So it does at least double duty. Watch Slashening, The Final Beginning.
Boom. Catherine, what have you been consuming?
So I do want to just come back to my recommendation from last week real quick. I am still reading The Fifth Heart, which, speaking of DC set things, a bunch of the book takes place in DC and has also really good DC geography. There's like some excellent Sherlock Holmes goes and beats someone up in a tenement in Foggy Bottom stuff that I could not recommend highly enough. So that did turn out to be a good recommendation, and I re-recommend it. But I also...
Is the tenement inside the State Department?
Like, TBD, but yeah. No, it's he has to, you know, he has to go buy some drugs. So he's he heads down to Foggy Bottom, of course, and then returns to the Hay Adams house afterward. So but my recommendation for this week is the first two episodes of Slate's, I think, fifth season of the Slow Burn podcast, which really is just a great podcast. It's so freaking good, you guys. But the fifth season is about the build up to the Iraq War. And my experience of listening to this one has been very different than all the others because it's a thing that I remember. But it's told like history. And I think other people said this about the Watergate episodes and also the Clinton Lewinsky episodes, both of which I remember as history, essentially. But in the run-up to the Iraq War, I was working at the Weekly Standard and helping start the Iraq War. So I had this very interesting experience listening to the first two episodes, which I did while hiking in Rock Creek Park with my husband, because that's a date. We just each put in an earbud and listen to Slow Burn. Yep.
And, DC is a great city full of exciting people.
It's amazing because it's like all these names. It's like going to like the world's worst high school reunion. It's just like all these names that you had been sort of trying to forget, and they just like reemerge into this narrative. I would say it's told fairly compassionately to people like me, and by the way, also 3/4 of the country who thought that Saddam Hussein was uniquely terrible, that it would be a relatively low-cost American incursion with massive humanitarian benefits as well as potential to stabilize the Middle East. And boy, howdy, were we not right about that.
Nick Gillespie's snort-triggering consumption was a 2010 documentary called Rush, Beyond the Lighted Stage. Ooh, I got an ooh.
You didn't get a snort, you got a ooh.
I got an ooh.
That sounds wonderful. Yeah. An intake of breath and anticipation.
Look, I'm the one with the keyboard next to me, so don't even get me started. It's great. I'm a kind of passive consumer of Rush, not a super fan. I had at some point Permanent Waves and Moving Pictures or whatever, the two kind of biggest late 70s, early 80s records. And I'm always perfectly happy to hear them on the radio, even if I don't like that many drum fills necessarily. But, you know, Canadian power trio, iconic, kind of treated with derision by critics for almost all of their lives. And then, especially towards the end of this particular documentary, there's kind of a rapprochement. Actually, Stephen Colbert plays a role in that. The first television appearance in America in 33 years was Colbert, like giving them cool points. But I liked it in a similar way that I liked a thing that I think Nick recommended. There was a documentary about kind of the John and Yoko and the making of the record Imagine. This Rush thing was done, obviously, with a full cooperation of the band members. And so it's kind of just sort of like how they did their music and how they, you know, march through from their point of view through their own biographies. And at some point, I kind of like those things, which, you know, it's not the outsider view about the cultural importance of the band or anything like that. One thing that resonated especially and reminded me a lot of the Alex Winter Zappa documentary that Nick did a great interview with Alex Winter, the director, is that Geddy Lee, the bass player and shrill vocalist, and Alex Lifeson, the guitar player, both are like son of immigrant families, first generation immigrant families who like totally disappointed their parents by deciding that all they really cared about was rock music, but then also had a total like total first generation immigrant work ethic that's just off the charts. And always love to see that portrayed, not necessarily the immigrant thing, but just in band and rock music and alchemic stories about like the hard work. Like people who work really hard actually kind of it helps in the rock musics.
That is the saving grace of Bruce Springsteen's autobiography from a few years back. His work ethic, as well as that of Little Steven, stands out. Matt, did the Rush documentary, or how did it deal with that ornery question of Ayn Randism?
Almost did not even touch upon it. There's actually pretty funny. So Neil Peart, the drummer, who is the Randian of the band. And
who is Canadian?
They're all Canadian.
Wow.
Sounds racist somehow.
Don't.
Yeah, even really, really.
Begin to know what that means. But he was he's famously very Randian. 2112 and
The Trees is a brilliant song about one tree that is, I believe it's an oak that is being held back by the maples.
They just mostly talk about like he was a big reader and a thinker. And so this is part of what he does. There's a great little glimpse at the end that I keep thinking about for some reason, which is Alex Lifeson, who's sort of like the jovial meathead of the band, guitar player.
He gets drunk, he gets pulled over for drunk driving on an almost annual basis on New Year's Eve.
If you haven't seen,
like,
and what this wasn't in the documentary, if you haven't seen Lifeson's speech at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame induction, it's a classic in comedy that's funny and then not funny. And then because the not funny is extended for so long, you just gotta hand it to him, as Wint says. But
have to hand it to them.
There's just a scene of Alex there on the tour bus late in life, and he's reading God Is Not Great, I think it was, the Hitchens book. And like, who would have guessed that Alex Lifeson could read, let alone be reading this Blasto from El Pasto back in the big atheist days. But anyways, recommend it.
Is that a Jim Laddism, Matt Welch? Did you pick that up from the great voice of SoCal?
She got it. This pony has long legs. Anyways, I liked it, and I recommend it for all of you people out there. The end, as they say. Thank you for all listening to this extended edition, the Jim Ladd edition, the headsets edition of Reason Roundtable Podcast. Check out all of our podcasts at reason.com/podcasts, including the Reason interview with Nick Gillespie, the Soho Forum, Gene Epstein, and family. And we'll see you next week. Goodbye.